It's Wednesday, August 5th, 2020, just after market close in New York. This is the Real Vision Daily Briefing. I'm Ash Bennington in New York, joined shortly by our managing editor, Ed Harrison. We're skipping the intro today because some of our folks here in the tri-state area are still without power from the tropical storm. Ed, welcome back.
Yeah, thank you, Ash. It's a difficult day in many ways. I mean, you talked about the storm in the tri-state area there. We had it as well. But in Beirut, you know, where 300,000 people have been displaced and, you know, there are hundreds dead. Our solidarity is definitely with them today. And it's been a difficult sort of human tragedy over there.
Yeah, very difficult. The video, hard to watch, frankly.
So, you know, it's hard to talk about markets in that context, but there are a decent number of numbers that have been coming out in the U.S. that I'm looking at and thinking about in terms of what the U.S. economic situation is.
Yeah. Ed, one of the things that we spoke about this morning were the ADP payroll numbers. What are your thoughts there?
Yeah, so the ADP payroll numbers were really, really weak. In fact, they were projecting 1.5 million jobs added in the last month, and we only got 167,000. So, I mean, when you talk about misses, that's a gargantuan miss. First of all, it tells you the scale of the job loss slash gains that we're talking about as a result of the pandemic, and it gives you a sense of how difficult it is to forecast in this environment. But in addition to that, really what it points out is that there is definitely some slowing that's going on, that we are definitely seeing slowing of the U.S. economy. You can't only add 167,000 jobs in July without it being a sign that things are not well in the U.S. economy.
Yeah, you know, it also, for me at least, reminded me of another theme that we've talked about and that you were early to the party on, which is just how distorted these jobs markets numbers have become in the wake of coronavirus. Now, markets basically shrugged off this hideous number, 167,000 new jobs, 1 million were supposed to be added. We're up on the day. The S&P closed at 33.27, up about half a point. And what this tells you is that markets, for whatever reason, are discounting that number and believing that it is not in touch with reality. And in fact, if you look at ADP and other jobs forecasts, they've been dramatically out of sync with the actual numbers that come out from the official reporting agencies. So it's sort of what you were saying, Ed, about how the predictive analytics, the whole framework of interpretation for these numbers works really well when you're between A and B, but when you go from A to W, those numbers fail you.
And you know, you mentioned the pandemic and coronavirus. A lot of people, every once in a while, they're like, "Why are you talking about coronavirus? Why are you speaking about the pandemic?" I didn't come here to talk about the pandemic, but the pandemic is everything right now, everything that we do. The reason I'm in this room where I am right now is because of the pandemic. Otherwise, we'd be doing this broadcast in New York City where you are, but I'm here for that reason. Everything that's going on in the economy is directly affected by the pandemic. And so when we talk about the pandemic, we're thinking about the economy, we're thinking about markets, but from the position of how is the pandemic, how is coronavirus related to what's going on? A perfect example is this ADP number that you're talking about, how difficult it is to forecast, and also how weak that number is in the wake of a second wave of coronavirus. So the question is that 167,000 number, is it really suggestive of absolute weakness, or is it a combination of weakness and just the variability and numbers that we get as a result of the coronavirus? So I think that's really how we have to think about things right now. The coronavirus is basically dominating economics and finance.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. You know, for me, Ed, the two topics that I dislike talking about most are the coronavirus, and number two, which is probably actually number one, is politics. But unfortunately, this is just where we find ourselves. Our remit is to cover markets, to cover the economy, and to cover what's happening that's driving those two things. And unfortunately, there's just no other way to do it. I mean, not talking about coronavirus and not talking about the election coming up in November would be like covering markets in 1941 without talking about the war.
Exactly. Because, as you know, it's been a long time since I've talked about a war. It's a war that we want to win. I look at this definitely as a war against the virus. And we are actually losing the war in the United States at this moment. I mean, we're not losing it abjectly. If you take a look at the PMI numbers, because, you know, I was looking at the composite PMI that came out from market. For the U.S., the numbers came in at 50.3. That was the composite PMI number. The 50.0, you know, right on the dotted line number, that was the expectation. So we are slightly into growth based upon the PMI, and we also slightly beat expectation. The question is, unfortunately, again, because of coronavirus and the second wave, what's going to happen to that number going forward? And it's still very much unclear what's going to happen. What we do know is that the numbers were probably going to roll over. They certainly have in terms of employment, but we should expect them to roll over both in terms of production as well as consumption.
Yeah. And, you know, as we've said so many times on this broadcast, this is a diffusion index. It's an oscillator. Numbers above 50.0 represent expansion, but it is on a relative basis from prior month. So if you have a significant series of contractions month after month after month, as we've had, then even positive prints are not getting you back to where you were. So it's not like a stock going, for example, from 75 to 50 and then going back to 75 and you say, okay, we're even. It doesn't work that way. These numbers are cumulative and they're about the figuring out where you were relative to where you started. And that is down, down, down.
Yeah. And, you know, just to piggyback on that, as you know, the number 32.9, that was the GDP number that we got, the preliminary number for Q2 2020, that works out to be 9.5% on an absolute basis. The number that people are talking about now is around 17% annualized for Q3. The GDP now number is up to about 20% at this point in time. That's the Atlanta Fed's nowcast number. So when we talk about 32% down annualized and then an uptick of 17 or 18%, 20%, that's not going to get you all the way back to where you need to be. And even that number is now in jeopardy. So when you talk about, you know, the 50 not getting you where you need to be, that's a perfect example of how. You know, let me just say, going back to the coronavirus and pandemic, the numbers for Sweden came out today, and they were better than the rest of Europe. The Eurozone, they beat the Eurozone by 3 or 4 percentage points. And so the question is what is the what can we take away from that? And what does it mean for us to how we think about the economy going forward? I mean, the way that I've been putting it is that we all want to get to the Swedish outcome. That is what we want is what we want to get to an outcome that is sustainable over the longer term and that is minimally restrictive. And that's going to be the outcome that gets you to something that will be sustainable over the long term, that will keep your economy going. The United States has tried to do that through the back door without doing all the necessary things in terms of social distancing, et cetera. And as a result, we've seen, you know, a catastrophic second wave. But if you can keep the numbers going down, then you can get to that point and then we can move forward in a new normal that's not like the old normal, but is as close to the old normal as we possibly can get.
Yeah, it's interesting to see the relative outperformance of Sweden and different policies taking place there. I remember talking to one of my Swedish friends earlier in the crisis, and his exact words to me were, you know, we have scientists too, and we're looking at this. So it is interesting to see this diversity of approaches throughout the world. The other interesting thing about the United States versus, for example, Sweden or France or the UK is we have a far greater proportion of authority devolved onto the state level here, meaning the actual states, not state nation state. So we have a diversity of responses here in the U.S. This isn't something that we see in Europe, in Germany, in France, in Sweden. These decisions are made at the federal level rather than at the local level or state level.
And one more thing on the coronavirus that I think is interesting to note. Because in Europe, the numbers are low in Europe. If you look at a chart and you look at the case numbers in, say, Germany, as an example, you see a massive spike up and then a relatively low tail from, say, April or May timeframe to today. But there has been an uptick in all of these countries. Every single one of them have had upticks. There's slightly more in certain places, Belgium, Spain, for example, but even Norway, which has been a model, has seen an uptick. And the same is true in other places in Asia, and Australia is another country that's seen an uptick. So it will be interesting to see what this uptick means in terms of the spread of the virus, what sort of impacts it's going to have in terms of policy, and also how that affects growth going forward. My baseline view is that the numbers are so low at this point that it's not going to have a huge impact, and that as a result, we'll likely see Europe outperform the United States in Q3 and perhaps Q4 as well. Let's just see how that pans out.
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called PIE, People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know you at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends. So for me, it's, you know.
Trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to. Podcasts on?
Yeah, podcast, homecasts.
Your podcasting apparatus? Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
Yeah, it's interesting to note, to just pull back to what you said, the Atlanta Nowcast now at 20.3% positive off basically 33% negative on prior quarter. We've never seen swings anything like this. You know, we have these discussions. Sometimes it seems like it's become normal. It's not normal. These are not normal swings in the numbers.
No, not at all. So what is my thinking now in terms of the U.S. economy? I think the U.S. economy, the question is how does ADP, as you were saying, relate to the jobs numbers that we're going to get out? It's hard to say because there's so much uncertainty in terms of the ADP is not very predictive in general of the jobs numbers. It's also not, in this particular time, not very predictive because we have these wide swings. But also remember that ADP numbers are giving you a later view than the actual numbers that we get from the government. The government's numbers are only through halfway into the month. So I would say that we should expect the government's numbers to be better than the ADP numbers. What I'm looking at in terms of real-time data from a jobs perspective is the unemployment claims numbers, so the initial claims in particular. So I think it will be interesting to see what the numbers look like for that tomorrow, because what we've seen actually is the numbers in a seasonally adjusted basis have ticked up 3 weeks in a row, but actually the non-seasonally adjusted numbers have gone down. That is they've gone down from 1.5 million down to, I believe the last number I saw was something like 1.2 million. So that's a decline, an actual decline of 300,000 initial claims over that period of time. If that continues into this week, we might actually get a decline in the seasonally adjusted number as well, because the adjustment factors aren't as great. But my expectation is that we are going to see continued pressure on jobless claims, and that the number may end up being greater than we would want it to be.
Yeah. And, you know, the seasonal adjustment factor distortions were a party that you were early to as well. I know we've talked about this extensively. You printed up a spreadsheet that you and I looked at. Could you explain, when you're talking about how the seasonal adjustment swing factor is going to be diminishing this time around, could you explain a little bit, give a little bit of color on what that means and why it matters?
Yeah. So basically what happens is that throughout the year, people are laid off. There are more initial jobless claims at different levels based upon seasonality of employment. And so knowing this, there's an adjustment factor that's decided way ahead of time in order to make it so that you can compare a number in January to a number in September. Otherwise, suddenly you would see a spike up in the number and you'd say, oh, wait a minute, bad things are happening. Or you would see a huge shift down and you would think something else is going on. But we have the statisticians who are able to normalize that over the period. The problem, of course, comes in where actually the normalized number is a fraction of the pandemic number. So you can think of the number of people who would normally actually file for unemployment as this small amount, and then a huge amount more as a result of the pandemic. That whole number is going to be adjusted by the seasonal factor. And so when you adjust the whole number by the seasonal factor, a distortion gets into the numbers. And we're at a period in time where that seasonal factor is shifting at a very high rate. It's gone from under counting the number of people who are actually filing for unemployment claims to overcounting. So now we're at an adjustment factor of something like 85 or 80 out of 100. So that means that the number that you get will be expanded by dividing by 80 and then multiplying by 100. And so you get an outsized number. And I believe that to the degree that more people are, and this is true, that we've seen a second wave of furloughs, the right. more people that are in the second wave, the more likely, therefore, those pandemic-related furloughs are going to be magnified into the number that we see tomorrow.
Yeah. And not only so that adjustment factor is actually shrinking, and then it flips and it goes in the opposite direction.
Exactly. Yeah. So you're dividing by the seasonal factor. And even if the seasonal factor is shrinking, it actually, because you're dividing by it, magnifies the number. And to the degree that you have a pandemic related non-seasonally adjusted a cohort that's very large, then you're going to get a huge increase that is not necessarily reflective of the underlying conditions on the ground.
Still kills me that they do it as a divisor and not as a multiplier, because the numbers
right. Yeah, it really bothers me, actually. I'm glad that it bothers you as well.
Statisticians have reasons all their own. You know, to pick up on something that you said earlier, these numbers that are coming out tomorrow on Thursday are the weekly employment claims number. And this is actually an official number. And then on Friday, we've got the NFP number, the non-farm payroll number that comes out with the EMPSIT report, the employment situation report from the DOL, Department of Labor.
Right.
Bureau of Labor Statistics at DOL, I think.
And, you know, I think that we'd be remiss if we didn't round out our commentary today with some thinking about the huge word that someone said we say all the time now, bifurcation. The difference between what's happening in the real economy and what's happening in the market economy. I remember earlier in this broadcast you were saying the market's acting like this number doesn't mean anything. It shrugged it off. Maybe actually the market doesn't care, because the market is a force onto its own. It's run via liquidity. That liquidity means that what happens in the real economy is not necessarily important until it is important. You know, we're still at that point where we don't know what the long-term situation will be. But if the long-term situation is demonstrably better than it is today, then the market's going to rally over time. If it's demonstrably poor at some point in time, that I believe that will feed through into the market, and then the market will adjust as a result of that. But over the short term, the market's just going to gyrate. And then that's where you get another bifurcation, the bifurcation between the winners of this new normal that we're in and the losers. And it seems that the tech stocks are the winners.
Yeah, that's exactly right, Ed. It's like we've got a bifurcation of a bifurcation here. You have the pricing mechanism in U.S. equity markets that bifurcates from the real economy. And then within that, you've got the bifurcation of tech stocks, big cap tech stocks, and everything else. Look, I don't know if a chart is worth a trillion dollars or a trillion words, but if you look at this chart here that shows basically the outperformance of Amazon, Apple, Alphabet, Facebook relative to the S&P on a year-to-date basis, it is just absolutely striking. And when you look at those numbers, I know we talked a little bit about this earlier, it's a relatively slow day in markets today. And I spent a little bit of time just going back and reading the old stories from last week about the earnings reports. And look, these numbers are really striking. I mean, this is I think the Wall Street Journal used a phrase that we're fond of at Real Vision, an embarrassment of riches for technology companies. And this is absolutely what that is. Another way of saying it, a perhaps more cynical way of saying it, would be that these companies are embedded in absolutely every aspect of our day-to-day lives. And their performance, their relative outperformance compared to the rest of the market shows how the world is moving toward a paradigm that they profit from immensely.
And, you know, that is the thing that is going to get them a lot of attention, a lot of negative attention. And we saw that negative attention last week when they were in front of Congress having to explain their so-called anti-competitive practices. And yeah. The interesting bit for me, and we talked about this before we came on, is who was there and how I'm thinking about who the beneficiaries of the new normal are. I mean, if I had to rank order the companies that you're talking about, I would rank order Amazon as number one, completely leveraged to the virtual world, the new normal. I would say that Apple is second behind them. I would say that Facebook is behind Apple and that Google is the laggard, so to speak, because even though they're online, they're very much dependent on the macro economy. You know, advertising has gone down and they're completely leveraged to advertising. And as a result of that, their numbers went down. Their top line went down for the first time since they've been a public company. And the interesting bit is the company that I didn't mention, one that was not under the gun last week, Microsoft. Yeah. Microsoft had a good earnings report. Microsoft is incredibly leveraged to the internet and they get a free pass. I have no idea how they get away with it, but they have done a spectacular job of being able to slip under the radar. This is a trillion-dollar company slipping under the radar.
Yeah, there has to be no one more pleased about that than Microsoft management and shareholders. You know, during that testimony, Satya Nadella, the CEO of Microsoft, was sitting on his couch in Medina, Washington, or wherever he is, watching this as a spectator. That is a tremendous coup. You know, you pointed out, and we talked a little bit about this earlier, Azure, which is Microsoft's cloud services platform, is absolutely crushing it right now. They're just doing gangbusters business. But because it's something that doesn't have direct interface to consumers, because it's basically a B2B product, it's something that there's a lot less interest in from regulators and lawmakers. And for Microsoft, that's a very good thing. You know, the other thing that struck me, and this is something we also talked about, was this idea that while Bill Gates no longer has a formal role at Microsoft, he is the largest shareholder of that company. And you better believe that one of the smartest people in the world who went through exactly the experience that Facebook is getting right now when he was a young, brash, controversial tech executive, remembers in the year 1999, which you and I remember well, that Judge Penfield Jackson antitrust case against Microsoft where it nearly got broken up. And I'm sure that those are lessons that are deeply in his DNA and in the DNA of Microsoft now, how to avoid precisely that type of controversy.
Yeah. And, you know, for me, the funny thing about it is Penfield Jackson's daughter went to my college and was a roommate of mine, you know, a few years before that, after I left college. So, you know, when I saw her dad, taking on Microsoft in a very open way, it definitely hit home viscerally that this was going on. I completely agree with what you have to say. And the thing that I would highlight from your remarks is the part about the consumer business, that Microsoft is taking the tack that they're a B2B company. That's where they got their bread and butter from Office. It's actually in the consumer market where they were crushed. That is that the monopoly power that they were seen as having was as a result of tying together their consumer business and their B2B business.
Yeah.
Now they've understood that we're a business oriented company. We're not going to get into the consumer market, and bravo for them, because that allows them to slip under the radar. No one really cares about their data, and it's great. They'll continue to earn. So, I mean, if I had to pick of those companies, the ones that are most leveraged other than Amazon, I would say that Microsoft is a company that I would watch and look at.
It's also an extraordinarily well-run company. It's a CPA's dream. There are only two companies in the United States right now that have AAA credit ratings. Microsoft is one of them. The other, of course, being J&J. But this is a very well-run company. I would love to see someone do a piece, a write-up. If I had the time, I'd do it myself, to see how much cash Microsoft has thrown off to shareholders over its 30-some-odd years in public markets. It's a pretty astonishing figure. It's just an incredibly well-run company. You know, and that brings up the point of some of the other companies there and what some of their challenges are. I think the company that's probably also reasonably in good shape is Apple. Apple's, Tim Cook kind of reminded me of the kid who got picked last at dodgeball during the hearings there. No one wanted to talk to him, which must have made Mr. Cook extremely happy. The focus, the heat was elsewhere. Look, Apple caught a little bit of heat, obviously, for their bundling practices for services revenue in the Apple App Store. Basically, Apple takes about a 30% rip on the revenue that comes off of other third-party developers selling their applications, both for iPhone, iPad, and Mac. But look, this is a growing area for Apple, and services revenue is always a holy grail for tech companies. But the bottom line is Apple makes money selling products on fat margins. That's a pretty good business to be in. Their quarterly sales increased 11% on a year-over-year basis. Their profits increased 12%. This is despite Apple stores all across the country being closed, some opening and then closing again. That's a pretty favorable sign for a company, isn't it?
It is. You know, and in fact, let me tell you that I bought a mini while Apple store, which is probably, I would say, 2 miles down the road, a mile and a half down the road, was closed. They shipped it to me. I started it up. This is during the crisis. So the crisis happened. I was forced to come here, and I got myself a new computer from Apple, even though their stores were closed. That's how it works. You know, Apple is in a very positive position from that perspective as well. So that's why I would put them at number two. Interestingly, Facebook was talking about Google and, you know, the fact that they had Android, and they were talking about Apple and the fact that they had iOS. Constantly, Zuckerberg was really throwing zingers at his rivals because he's the one where I think the biggest risk is. The biggest risk going forward is for Facebook.
Yes.
And it's not just the risk for them in terms of antitrust, but you think about in terms of TikTok as an example, how they're trying to get a rival to TikTok into Instagram and so forth. They're the company that has the least effective moats, and I would be most troubled to own over the long term. And as I say all this, by the way, I'm thinking first and foremost about your friend Aswath Damodaran, who we've talked about, that we need to get him on the show, have him talk to us about this, and do some discounted cash flow modeling for us and tell us what are these companies really worth now in this particular point in time. Can you pay 25 times earnings for Microsoft or Apple, or should you pay 10 times earnings for them? What's the number? I'd be interested to see what he has to say.
Yeah, I would be really interested as well. And as just to your other point, I actually bought an iMac during that period as well, got it delivered to the house, and life goes on. Look, I think you're spot on also about Facebook. You know, the reality is that the Zuck throwing zingers is kind of a new thing. That isn't something that we've seen. We haven't seen him throwing shade toward some of the other large tech companies. That doesn't strike me as something that's coming from a position of strength. you know, that it seems like a deviation where when you're feeling the pressure, when you're feeling the heat, you point out and you go, well, look what the guy across the street is doing. That's not a good sign. You know, I also think that from a moat perspective, Facebook has the least defensible position because they're most susceptible to innovation removing them from their massively dominant position in the social media and social networking space. Why? Because, you know, your son or your daughter can come up with a better Facebook. And it could be mobile first. It could be something that I don't know because I'm not young anymore. But people who want to move in that direction, it's something that is, if you think about Zuck's own origin story, Facebook's own origin story, it's a couple of smart kids hanging out at a university who come up with an idea. You and I and no one we know is going to disintermediate Apple. It's just not
right. And, you know, my view is that the antitrust is going to increase over time for these big companies. And that makes Facebook, of all of these companies, most vulnerable, because basically what they need to do, and the documents have proved this out when they had discovery, is they need to buy their competitors out. You know, you see someone who is a threat, Instagram, let's buy them. You know, you see someone who's a threat, WhatsApp, let's buy them. That's what you do. You have an elevated stock, you buy them out. Or in the case of Amazon, with something that Facebook can't do, they just price at cost or below cost and then drive the competitor out of business. But I think that it's the mergers that will actually fall in antitrust more prominently. It yeah. will be interesting to see if this happens under a Trump administration, you know, a Trump 2 administration, or under a Biden 2 administration. My view is that under both regimes, you will get more robust antitrust, perhaps more robust under a Biden administration than under a Trump administration.
Yeah. And I think your bigger point stands, right? Which is, it almost doesn't matter at this point. You know, the other layer that I would add to that from Facebook's perspective is, it's really a bad sign when AOC and Ted Cruz are both gunning for your CEO. That's not something that happens often. There's almost unanimity among the Washington power elite that the size, scale, and reach of Facebook makes them a threat. For various reasons, depending upon whether you're coming at it from the perspective of the left or coming at it from the perspective of the right. But the agreement is universal that there is risk in Facebook controlling so much information.
So, you know, going forward, just to wrap this up and think about what does this all mean for the markets, I'm still of the belief that we're looking at a September to October bogey. I think that markets can keep ripping through August, based upon money flows. But I believe that the accumulated information that we receive over the next month and a half will be enough to alter the path of the markets. Whether that means you have a continuation of upside or suddenly downside risk enters the picture, we'll find out soon. But, you know, how the fiscal cliff is resolved, what these numbers look like on a weekly basis for jobless claims, what the jobs numbers look like, and also what happens with consumption and production as we go through this second wave, I think is very important. And eventually that's going to mean that fundamentals matter, but it just will take time.
Yeah, and you've been remarkably consistent with that time frame, always citing that as the crucial kind of acid test for where we are. You know, I would just add to that, if we could flip up that chart one more time, the chart worth a trillion words. Look, you know, this conversation about tech stocks is not just idle philosophical speculation. When you look at those, returns to date, the really startling thing, and I should have pointed this out earlier, is that the S&P 500 obviously includes these names. And S&P 500, as shown in this chart, is not net of Amazon, Apple, Facebook. And so what you're seeing is even with those numbers baked in, S&P is still flat. You have massive outperformance from those stocks. So what does that tell you about the impact that those stocks will have on a broader U.S. equity market valuation?
Just wait until Tesla joins the party.
Yes, indeed. You know, I don't know if you saw this, but Apple, just to give you an idea of one of the reasons why we follow the S&P and not the Dow. So Apple is going to be doing a 4-for-1 split, trading around $400 now, going to be down, I think 440 was the last print I saw. It's going to be down probably closer to 100 after this. This is going to mean that Apple is no longer the largest component in the Dow because the Dow weights on a price-weighted basis, which makes absolutely no sense, right? It's literally, there's no actual economic impact to an adjustment from a split. It's just done so that retail investors have greater access to the shares. In the era of fractional share trading, I'm not sure that matters as much anymore, but that's another story. But it does go to show why it's so important to look at the right indexes and understand how they're weighted.
100% agree, Ash. As usual, it's been fun. You know, we're not going to do it again tomorrow, but hopefully we'll be back together on Friday.
It's always fun, Ed. See you soon.
Take care.